And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started. Well, Patty Quatro, I am mind blown about how much is happening for you and the Pleasure Seekers. And yes, we are still in the first few months of 1968. And no, this is not a repeat of the last episode because it's just incredible. And so on the previous episodes, we've been talking about ABC booking you. You're soon now about to record with Mercury Records. You're touring constantly on national television and working on a film, no less, with Frank Sinatra and Richard Conte, which, yes, Leo Fenn took you out of it, but still. And you're hanging out with the Glitterati in Miami Beach and tons of press, which we read from. There's so much more. And Arlene's big splash in the Sunday magazine that we read from. But there is another thing that's happening amongst all of this excitement. And this is a really big deal. This is historic. So in addition to all of this, Leo Fenn, your amazing manager, secures a sponsorship with Slingerland for Darlene, Dar Thumper Arnone, your drummer. And I want to hear how all of this happened, but I also need to ask you, Patty, and confirm this. I believe she's then, therefore, the first female rock and roll drummer to get a sponsorship. And so I just, tell me everything about this moment. I think it's historic.
She was absolutely the first. And I think Joe made the call, actually. You know, Leo put it together, but Joe made the call to them, you know, to tell them about Darlene at Slingerland. So, and I want to do a quick aside on the dates. You know, these dates, you know, copied from people that cover us and write diaries about us. This happened really quick after Gillies, and I wasn't even positive of the ending date of Gillies because I know that Leo and Darlene shot into that car and drove right up to Chicago, and we went on to New York. So they get to Chicago, Slingerland Factory, on a very fast trip, and she was the first one that was ever sponsored by Slingerland, a girl drummer. It's amazing that that happened. And she played like a motherfucker. And everyone who experienced her talent knew it. When she did her drum solos, mouths would drop open. She was so excited at the factory. She was like a kid in a candy store. She was able to grab double bass drums. And I think she got that from other bands that were starting to do double bass, like Keith Moon. I call him Mooney. So anytime I say Mooney, that's Keith Moon. And she just wanted to have that. So she picked up double bass drums too. She had a pink set with her name on it. She was always elevating herself. Okay. They did their biz at the factory. They picked their stuff and they got right back in the car back to New York. It was an exciting as hell trip for her.
Well, so you answered my question, which was why did she decide to do two bass drums? AKA Mooney, right? In the sense of who she's trying to emulate. But did she have to adjust? If this is all going, this is fast. She goes from Chicago back to New York. You're all going to New York. Was there any kind of learning curve to play two bass drums?
You know what? She was so damn good on drums. She just picked it right up. I don't know how she did it. I don't know how, but she was playing those doubles immediately. I mean, they came into the band and there they were, and she was going to be a double bass drummer. It was amazing.
That is amazing. And we obviously have pictures. People have seen it, but now the backstory is there. I mean, I keep saying it, but it's historic. So you're done making waves in Miami, as you said. You're back in New York, and the Pleasure Seekers are in the city now in New York. And you go back to stay at the Gorham Hotel or Gorham Hotel. And
Yes.
we've talked about this hotel in the past. But we didn't really talk about it. And we have even more stories to come that's not in today's episode. But this
Oh.
one is incredible, dare I say. I think it's amazing. So, Patty, please, before we even get to the stories, can you remind our listeners about the Gorham Hotel?
That was the place for bands to stay. It really was known as a band hotel. It was the precursor to the Riot House in LA. It really was. That was the earliest one. And it was just inhabited by all the rock bands that would come to town. It was on 55th Street. So it was very central. You could walk to restaurants and everything. The bands loved staying there. Some of the rooms had little kitchenettes and stuff. It was just perfect. Perfect. We loved it.
Well, I love that too. And for those who don't know your reference, you're talking about the Hyatt or the Riot, which is in LA. And so
Yes.
this is the New York version of it, which I love. And so tell us why you're heading back to New York. You obviously are being booked again, or what else is going on?
We did something odd. We knew we were going into New York and going to play at Arthur's and stuff, and the Mercury recording would be coming up. And we decided, oddly, to go into a studio, a local studio in New York, and do a cover. We just wanted to get a little more studio experience, you know.
Just you and Leo?
No, the band. We
I mean, the
decided
band.
to go to book a session at the recording studio in town, and we went in to do a one day, one song recording. And that, what happened there was hilarious.
Well, I want to hear that. I just need to clarify. So, is this Mercury Records funding this single? This is just the band
Nope.
and Leo going into a studio to make a single. Okay, so tell us now
Absolutely.
about the rest of it. What
Okay,
happened?
so we get to the studio, right? And it was pretty booked up. Vanilla Fudge were there. The Rascals were there to record. And we're hanging out, making our way to our own session. And we met both bands, etc. The Vanilla Fudge were lounging on the floor, right? Lights out, listening to what they had just laid down. And the Rascals were recording in another studio. So we started our session, you know, in short order. And we decided to keep the lights off and keep the atmosphere, right? And what we did was we did Keep Me Hanging On by the Fudge. That's the song that we were going to do. No relation to them having been there, but we didn't. Again, would the Pleasure Seekers do a version of the Supremes version? No, I don't think so. We wanted to do the edgier version of that song, which was the Fudge's version. So there we are. We knocked out the song, lights off. Susie did a great job. Arlene nailed the organ parts. And all of a sudden, at the end of the song, right, the mixing room, the lights go on, and they're watching us, are the Fudge and the Rascals, with their mouths hanging open, and we could hear it. They're girls. Oh my God. I mean, they were a bit in shock. Now, Susie was still singing in her lower register, so I don't know if they thought she was the only female in the room when the lights were off, but they were in shock. It was just hilarious. So we were hanging out. It was a very cool session. And I think they were complimented that we were doing a cover on their song, right?
I just the coincidence of that, first of all. I
Yeah.
mean, that you were going to do that version or do their version, and they're in the recording studio doing their own stuff. That's just incredible, Patty. That's just amazing. How did you even decide to do that cover? Why
It
that?
was our show tunes. It was one of our best ones. Susie did a hell of a job on it. Arlene just did all that organ stuff with her moves and playing it. It was a favorite of the crowds. We did such a great version of it. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, sadly, we do not have a copy of that. We are
No.
going to be getting to Pleasure Seekers singles soon,
Oh,
but we
yeah.
don't have a copy of that. But I do now want to say, so now we can add recording to your repertoire. And you're also booked. We had talked about Arthur's. Now tell us about Arthur's. Arthur's, to me, I don't want to say it's on par with Trudy Heller's, but in terms of popularity, I mean, this was a very big deal, this nightclub. So tell us about Arthur's.
Well, music's such a big deal in New York. It's April 1968, and here we are in yet another brand new, exciting hotspot for the glitterati. It was a big celebrity hangout. It was owned by Sybil Burton. You remember Richard Burton, the actor, and
Of course.
Elizabeth Cleopatra, and the marriage broke up, and Sybil came to New York, and she opened up a club. Arthur's. And of course, she was well situated with celebrities and everybody. She'd been married to Richard Burton, for God's sakes. So she drew all these people to her new hot club. And we were booked in there for 2 weeks and we were held over again. We're always getting held over. And we had rave reviews of our stint at Arthur's. It was wonderful. Our reputation basically had preceded us upon our return to New York City. And she booked us.
Fantastic. Can you give us a little taste of some of the glitterati that were there?
Oh my God, this is something. Judy Garland, you know who she is, was a
Heard of
frequent
her.
visitor. Yeah, frequent visitor at the club. She hung out a lot. And oddly, she always brought her three kids, Liza, Lorna, and Joey. And it's odd they were allowed in being underage, but I guess she had her clout to make it happen. She was good friends with Sybil, and she was definitely into drinking and having fun. She wore a black dress a lot, this one black dress, and she had this big hat on all the time with this big wide brim. That was like her uniform coming there. And the kids got very close to us. They just adored the band. They loved hanging out with us in between sets, especially Lorna. And, they were very solicitous of Judy. They had to lead her home safely. She'd been drinking. They were always taking care of her. It was sort of wild to see that the little kids looking after their mom. And that's what happened. They would lead her home at the end of the night, and she was there a lot.
Wow. Well, I want to hear a little bit more about you and the Pleasure Seekers hanging out with Judy, Lorna, not Ju well, Judy, but Lorna, Liza, and Joey. What was the age difference? Were they little kids?
Joey was a little kid, the boy, and Liza was the older one, and Lorna was in between. And Lorna was more, I think, close to our age. And she was especially into the band. I mean, They just sat there all night listening. And the minute we were off stage, it was like, ah, that was great. And they were so cute. But
Wow,
yeah.
that's phenomenal. And so I know this next story that I can't wait for everybody to hear. Please tell us
Oh.
who else.
Oh my God.
Tell us, please. I'm just going to let you take the
Okay, there was a special political party thrown as a big event for McCarthy. Okay, and there were a lot of movie stars there and political people to support the party. So Paul Newman was there with Joanne Woodward and a whole bunch of other stars. And there were all these food kiosks set up all over the dance floor. They were doing food and different things, and we were the entertainment for the party. So at one point in between the sets, this is so hilarious, Paul was flirting with
Paul who? Paul who?
Paul Newman was flirting with Arlene Foxy Lading, and he was spoon feeding her cake to her mouth. Joanne strolled up and pulled him away, and
Joanne, his wife.
his wife, Joanne Woodward, and she pulled him away from her. It was, I mean, what a freaking handsome dude he was. And I'm sure Arlene was flipping out being spoon-fed by Paul Newman. I mean, talk about a golden god. Good
Oh.
Lord, was he good looking?
Well, he was, but also it makes me think of Arlene's nickname, Blue-Eyed Soul. You could say that about him, Paul Newman, looking at each other. I mean, these talk about gods and goddesses.
Oh,
So, was
God.
there any kind of scene with Joanne Woodward? And by the way, we have a picture of Paul Newman
Oh, yes, you do.
spoon feeding your sister. And so I'm just curious, how did Joanne handle it?
She just came and sort of dragged him by the arm and pulled him away. I mean, she was pretty firm about it. She didn't say anything. She didn't make any kind of scene or anything. It wasn't that obvious. But I mean, he was smiling away, feeding Arlene. I'm sure she just didn't like it. Arlene was a looker. So that's what happened
I really
there.
don't know any wives or that would be like, do it, go ahead, flirt with this bombshell, please. Who am I to
Oh my God.
That's just incredible. And the stories keep continuing. And the next part, I am overusing a word today, is another mind-blowing moment for the
Yes.
history of rock
Yes.
and roll writ large,
Oh
let
my God.
alone for the pleasure seekers. I just need to take a breath here because this is this moment where you're going to tell us about a band called The who had heard about Darlene's solo, now double bass drums, on their song, My Generation, that you guys covered. And
Yes.
they wanted to hear it because rumor got around. And so they came to see the Pleasure Seekers and all of you at Arthur's. So please tell us how all of this happened.
Oh my God. Well, as you can figure out, they were at the Gorham, same time we were. We were all at the Gorham with all the other rock bands. It was always filled with bands. And of course, in hanging out, they had heard about, double bass, and she was doing a big long solo. It was like 10 minutes long. And they were curious to see this young girl, I mean, teenager, doing a drum solo on their song. They showed up, of course. And they were shocked that she was already sponsored. I think that drew them in too, like, wow, you just got a sponsorship and the whole thing. So they show up to hear her play. They listen to the solo. They were very complimentary, very sweet. And they ran out of there like they were being chased after the solo because they were afraid of being mobbed by the fans.
Really?
Yeah, they got a little, oh, we got to get out of here. They hurt, they came, they heard, and they left. So it was pretty funny. I'm sure they were flattered that we were doing it on one of their songs. They stayed for the whole solo and whatever songs were preceding it. But then after the solo, got out of town, I mean, they moved.
I don't know if flattered is the right word that you, I mean, I bet they were mind blown.
I think they were pretty surprised what she did on those drums. I
Well, and
really.
all of you. I mean, clearly, if Vanilla Fudge is responding that way and the Rascals, why not the Who? I mean, it's just incredible. Well, I just now need to continue this mind-blowing moment with the Who. But I do need to say, and for those who listened to our previous episode about the Detroit uprisings, this was in 67. We called the episode Detroit is Burning, and that was a very intense moment for the pleasure seekers and the city because you were there and you were living in it. But there is now a moment, as you said, this is still April 1968, and we need to talk about this another historic event, but this is now a global historic event. And so I just want to set the stage that on April 4th, this is right there when you're in New York, 1968, the news comes out about the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. Now, unlike your previous personal encounter with the riots in Detroit, where you had to flee and you were at a gig and your parents left with you, this was, you were witness, wit, well, I can't even say it, witnessing this from afar. But it was still a major event. I mean, chaos was in the air. This was an assassination of a leader. And so I would like to know first, before we get to the story, how did you, the pleasure seekers and Leo Fenn, were you directly impacted by this at the Gorham Hotel? How did you hear about it?
Well, it was all over the news. It was the day before. And, we were all at the hotel. I mean, in residence at the hotel with us were the Blues Magoos, Ted Nugent, the Marley Brothers, and the Who, and the Pleasure Seekers. I mean, it was a packed hotel. You would get a contact high constantly and walking through the lobby and floors from the weed permeating the hotel from the bands and the Marleys. I mean, that night, there was a lot of partying going on. We had the night off and we knew what had happened because it was all over the news, but we were partying down and all the bands were hanging and getting loose, just blowing off steam. Leo and Corby were there. And at this moment in time, everyone was just having a good time. No one was being disrespectful to us girls. I think we were probably the only girls there. Maybe the Marleys had some wives there because they traveled a lot with some of the wives. And we were happy to be able to let loose a little bit. And we were already cool with Nugent and the Blues Magoos because we were friends with them already. And the doors were all open in the hallways. We were going from floor to floor and hanging out and partying. It was nighttime, and then the madness and mayhem began. Oh my God. Probably the male bands by now were getting a little drunk as the evening went on. So one of the Blues Magoos, Jeff, the drummer, decides to let off a kind of aerial fireworks out of the Pleasure Seekers hotel window and into the in-progress construction site of this tall high-rise next door. It was just all metal framework, right? Real tall. And the sky lit up. Oh my God. Oh shit. Oh my, you could hear it, see it lit up. Bands started running through the halls. It was nuts. So, in very short order, the cop cars show up at the construction site going through it, trying to figure out, oh my God. I mean, it's right after Martin Luther King assassination. The whole country was on edge,
Absolutely.
And here we are partying down.
Did you see the cops at the other building going through it? I mean, did you hear all of this happening?
Well, we were looking through the windows. We could see it, of course, from our window. Mooney decides, Keith Moon decides to escalate the situation, as was his usual behavior. And he throws out some cherry bombs from the ninth floor window and onto the arriving cops. Oh my God. He had already nailed some furniture to the ceiling and turned on the room sprinklers. Then it got worse. It escalated. Now the cops are flowing into the Gorham Hotel. They probably heard a lot of noise as they're searching, right, with their searchlights and all the stuff. And Leo and Corby, now this is an aside that's interesting. They, because of things that had happened, they carried guns on the road, okay? They had a gun. Never used, never, but people trying to break in our rooms and stuff, it was just always there, never used, but they did have a gun. They threw them out the window because they were scared of getting the cops coming over and catching them with guns. So Leo throws us into our beds, right? Little Miss Innocence, our clothes were on, telling us to pretend to be asleep. Of course, we're not caught out with our Little Miss Innocence act when they come to our door. What's going on? Rubbing our eyes, like, what's going on? Everyone is arrested except us. The Who were ejected. And of course, the band managers bailed them all out quickly. We got off scot-free. And they really, it was hard for the cops to find any evidence. The stuff blew up, whatever. They didn't know who started it from the hotel. They knew damn well the bands did. That was a bit evident. But
Well, but this is so not the point, but I do have to ask. You said it smelled like reefer and all of this. I mean, that was very illegal back then. So as the cops are coming in, was there any confiscation of drugs or anything? I mean, what was the reasoning to have them arrested?
I don't know under what premises they arrested them. Probably they found drugs and drinking and what. I'm sure they used all of that to just haul the whole bunch of them down to the station and arrest them. I mean, the Who were ejected instantly. So, I mean, Keith was a, oh my God, he was always calling. Roger Daltrey used to complain to me. He said, "Oh my God, that boy! He never knew what to do with Keith Moon and his shenanigans." Now, this was just another incident. Keith was always going crazy.
Well, this is just incredible. And we are not done with stories about the Who, but I do want to finish this story for this episode because
Oh my
this is
God.
incredible. So the evening now is over. The arrests have been made. Managers have bailed them out. They're coming back to the Gorham to finish up. Are you guys still there? Are you going to be staying in New York?
We're all still there. Nothing changed. They got out of jail, whatever, and they're back at the hotel. All the bands are back at the hotel. Probably the Blues Magoos had left to go to their own home because they were from New York. Ted was still there. The Marleys were still there. So we go to bed, and it's the next morning. We are all saying goodbye downstairs outside the hotel. The Who's bus is there waiting to load. We're just reliving the craziness of the previous night, and Mooney speaks up suddenly, saying, "Oh my God, I forgot something upstairs." He disappears into the hotel. The next thing we know, a TV comes crashing down to the sidewalk. I have to encounter.
Hold on, Patty. This is such a famous story. And it is mind-blowing again to overuse a word that the pleasure seekers were in this moment in time with the Who and Mooney and the TV being thrown out the window. Go on.
I can encapsulate it pretty good in this crazy, scary night. That was the truly the night that the pleasure seekers were taken to school and more, with what we experienced and witnessed about what band life could now be and often was on the road with male bands. So here comes Mooney back out. That was a real lesson for us. Mooney comes back out, wiping his hands clean and saying, "Okay, we can leave now." And they obviously quickly depart, and we quickly left the scene. I don't know what happened, but Mooney had to just leave that one last calling card on the sidewalk, as Keith was wont to do. And off they went to the next hellacious adventure on their continuing tour. And you can bet your sweet ass the incident made the newspapers, and the Who got out of town, foot on the gas, as fast as their magic bus could take them. And I'm quite sure with Mooney getting quite an earful from Daltrey as they drove away.
Every day I get in the queue. takes me to you. I'm so nervous I just sit and smile. Your house is only another mile. Thank you, driver, for getting me here. You'll be an inspector, have no fear. I want it. Broken 10 sixpence every day, just to drive to my baby. Broken 10 sixpence each day, 'cause I drive my baby every way.
Magic horse, magic horse.